You are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indian Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends on AM 1510, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and on the World Wide Web.
Yes, World Wide Web at radio stations 1510wwbc.com. You can go there and click the on-demand button and get all of the shows that are on WWBC. But, of course, Sita and Friends is the one that you want to listen to. We're here every Monday from 1 to 2 o'clock. You can check us out. We also post all of our shows on Facebook and our newly created website, which is just still in a little bit of construction, but all of the shows for the last 3 months at least are there. And I'm working on the last 10 years, Sita.
Can
you believe
gosh.
It's been 10 years?
I can't believe it. So on Mondays, this has become part of my life. It's like I wake up, take a shower, relax, come to the studio, and this is just part of my day.
I was just going to say, your second living room.
And I go to the gym. And so Ellen and Samantha and myself, Sita Biggie, we sit here and we converse about things that are going on around the nation, right here in Brevard County, Florida, and globally as well. I like to say my show is international because it is.
It is.
We had Nandita that called in from Canada a couple of weeks ago. And today's no different. I mean, I have a really good lineup today, Ellen. But before we tell our guests who are tuning in, our listeners who are tuning in, I want to do my little Sita social, right?
Yeah.
We're very grateful that Anne-Marie Wolf is here to join us in the studio.
Yes.
My friend and your friend. And she's going to talk a little bit about the book that you just read in a few minutes.
I did.
Anne-Marie, welcome to our show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Sita. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Yeah, you know what, Al? We've been hearing a lot about inflation, right? Mm-hmm. And I do understand the people who are struggling, the people who need money for gas and they want an hourly wage increase and they're worried about their rent and things like that. But, you know, Anne-Marie's from Trinidad and so am I. Mm-hmm. And boy, did we learn how to stretch a dollar,
right?
So sometimes I hear people talk about this argument about inflation and that it's causing a shift into demand and supply. Mm-hmm. And then you hear about the coronavirus and what it did to our world.
Mm-hmm.
The COVID-19 just didn't affect the United States. It affected people globally. People died all over the world, whether they took the vaccines, whether they wore masks, whether they believed in conspiracy theories. I'm not sure what they didn't believe in. And some of them were morbidly obese, or they had some underlying health conditions and they passed away. That affected the supply chain. Mm-hmm. The president of the United States doesn't control the ports in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if people want to help here in our country with the inflation, I heard they need truckers.
That's right.
Okay? So if you want to help and you are a good driver, you're not drunk at the wheel, you don't have any DUIs, sign up to be a trucker because there's something called human beings makes the products or machines make the products. It is shipped from other countries to the United States to a port somewhere, and then we need those goods and services to a shelf near you.
That's right. Yeah, right? Exactly
right. Right. And I could say when I was a child and I saw a piece of clothing or a product that was says made in America, I know how I felt. Mm-hmm. I wanted to come to the greatest country in the world. Mm-hmm. And I still think that the American dream is alive and well. Don't you, Anne-Marie?
It's absolutely alive and well.
And what we think about with inflation, what we were talking about kind of offline, is to, you know, be mindful of the things that you're doing, like consolidating errand trips, like we were talking about, like what Dr. B does. You know, make sure that when you're going out, you plan out a route, that you get everything done while you're out there instead of wasting gas. And think about your food consumption. You know, think about things that you can be storing and, you know, getting back to kind of like that.
Basics.
Basics of the way we were all raised.
Yeah.
There was a lot of kids in my family, too.
Right.
And my mom was a master at making sure that she could stretch a dollar.
Well, the pandemic.
So we just have to get back to that.
Well, inflation is partly the result of the pandemic and shutdowns. And in the now pent-up, unleashed demand for goods and services, you know, supply, labor costs, everything, we have to take it into consideration. But you're right. I mean, I just celebrated the Hindu religion, our festival of lights, our New Year, Diwali. And I fed over 15 people in my home with less than $100. Mm-hmm. And I gave away 10 meals.
Right.
Well, how do you do that? It's common sense.
Well, it's not common sense because we don't teach that anymore in school. We don't teach home ec anymore in school. We don't teach
budgeting. Well, you don't have to learn that, though. I mean, you know, when you think about it, people want to eat a lot of meat. Well, yeah. Think about what the cows are doing to the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I mean, we ate vegetarian food, but I fed a lot of people. But anyways, we have a great guest.
I was just going to say, we could go on and on.
About
but
that.
We have fantastic local people.
I know. Our guest is on the phone. We have our first guest is Jody Neatheri. Did I say it correctly?
Neatheri.
There you go. Say it again.
Neatheri. Yes.
Neatheri. This Trinidadian accent, it gets me all the time. And so it's Jody Neatheri is calling in first. And then our second segment is Cindy Duke. She is a virologist and a physician and a medical director and a lab director of the Nevada Fertility Institute. She's also the sister of the actor Winston Duke, a friend of my friend. She's the daughter of my friend Cora Panton, and she'll be calling in the second segment, which Anne Marie and I, being from Trinidad, it's a treat for us. And so right now we're going to talk to Jody. Oh my gosh, your bio was so extensive that I said to the girls we'll have to cut it in a little bit, but we just want our listeners to know that Jody was born in Southern California. You left the palm trees and the smell of the oceans and the tumbleweeds. You also left the constant warnings from tornadoes and things like that, and you moved to Midland, Texas. And I read that you were classmates with the 43rd president of the United States, President Bush.
Yes, that's correct.
I like that because, you know what? I see some of the things he's doing now, and I smile every time I see him. I have a little warm feeling for him and Laura Bush. You know?
I love his artwork.
I do too.
Amazing.
His artwork and his horses and his farm and all that. It seems like he's found like nature. He's calm, right? Yeah. So
yes, he is.
Yes. Yep. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how's the weather where you are today?
Right now the weather is absolutely gorgeous. It is probably 70 degrees and a really light wind. It's absolutely beautiful here, and I'm inside looking out. So I'll get out there later, but it's really nice here. How's the weather in Florida today?
Today it was like beautiful. It was beautiful, but I wore my boots. It was a little chilly this morning.
Well, we get excited in Florida because we don't get to wear boots much.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we get excited if it's like
60 degrees.
We're in. We're like long sleeves and well, those of us who have fashionable clothes, you know, we want to wear them. So
exactly.
So your background, you were in banking as well. You kind of went to school with a lot of famous people. You also went to school with the U.S. military commanding officer in the Middle East.
He was in the same class as Laura Bush, and he commanded the military operations for the United States in the Middle East. So, he was quite a general. So,
wow.
Yeah, we had lots of those people in Midland. Dreamers and doers, full of them, and they dreamed and doed at the highest level. It was incredible, really.
Very ambitious. It's very ambitious.
Yes, very much.
You know, we were raised I was raised in the islands in Trinidad and Tobago, and I was talking to somebody at the gym this morning, and he was like, "You are such a go-getter. How do you do it?" And I said, "You know what? I wake up every day, and the world is my vacation spot. The earth is my vacation spot. I'm like, what can I do to make the lives of everyone better? What can I do to make my life better? What can I do to think positively and spread that positive cheer?" And it seems as though you're that kind of person as well, just from talking to you.
Yes, I buy into that completely. I think if you wake up in the morning and you don't have that kind of a goal, then you've lost your day and you've lost your way, maybe. So it, it's very inspiring, and when people respond to you in that way, it makes it all worthwhile, and you know that you've done a good job, and you've maybe helped one person, and that's all you can strive for, is somebody takes something positive from what you've done and they apply it to their life and maybe make their life a little bit better and maybe make them smile.
Yes, and I'm a long-term care nurse, and I went in yesterday to help out because we need nurses, and so I went in for 4 hours to work on my day off, and one of the patients, a 98-year-old woman, said to me, she says, honey, if everybody treated the elderly, the children, the people that they meet in life, like their mother and father or their grandmother and grandfather with respect, what a wonderful world we would have. And that resonated with me because that's how our religion teaches us to respect everyone that we come in contact with and treat people the way you want to be treated. And I think it's good for people like yourself and me and people of an insight who can write and convey a message for us to always keep that in mind. So
I agree.
Yes. So you wrote a couple of books. You wrote a novel.
Ma'am.
You wrote a book called A Kind of Hush. And then you wrote another one, Life in a Box. So I am curious because I want to know, where did you get your inspiration from to be a writer? And how did this dream come true for you?
Well, Life in a Box was the first one. It took about 5 years to write. It was semi-biographical, as many of the characters were plucked off of my family tree. So there was a built-in profile in there. It's always been my dream to write. I wrote down in 1999 in a journal that I had, it said, I love to write, and I secretly wish that I would write a novel one day. And 22 years later, I've written two, and I've got the third one in the incubator. So it's always been a dream. My grandmother was very inspirational. She wrote in her journals, and she always inspired me with a sense of wonderment and endless possibilities, that type of thing. But, stepping into that kind of a world that you're not familiar with and you don't have a background for, it's very scary. So it kind of takes, a kick in the you-know-what to get you started in that direction. And when you realize that maybe your time might be a little more limited than what you thought it might be, then there's an urgency that pushes you to the forefront. And my book club prodded and cheered and said, when is this going to be out? They wouldn't let me fail. And it was wonderful to be able to produce Life in a Box. And it was, as I said, semi-biographical. But A Kind of Hush was right out of my imagination. And ask a question, explores whether there's a gray area between right and wrong. Both of them are literary fiction. Both of them are family drama. Both of them have a lot of emotion in them, a lot of mystery, history, humor, heartache, love, betrayal. All those human conditions are in both of these books. I'm very, very proud of them, and it makes me smile every time somebody asks about them, as you can tell.
So. Well, the Mackey family, it seems as though everybody knows a family like this. It's just that you took the step to bring them to life.
Yes.
And where
especially
do you,
my little boy.
Yeah, and where do you find, where do you find your inspiration to bring the characters alive? Like, they're modeled after people in your family, or some of them you just say, okay, I'm going to bring this character in?
Well, Life in a Box obviously was a lot of the characters in there were based on my family, and so it was relatively not easy, because writing is not easy, but it was a little bit easier to draw from what I knew of my family. And my family was very eclectic in some respects, because it just was all personalities were all over the place, so it was a lot of fun to write about that. A Kind of Hush, the characters from that were just from my imagination. It started with young Gabriel Edward Mackey. He came to me in the middle of the night. I scratched out his profile in the dark, and the first few sentences of the novel and the ending And from that, all the other characters developed. He had to have, obviously, parents and grandparents and that type of thing.
That is interesting. So you, that's interesting. You did the beginning and the end, and then you filled in the middle. Man, you know, you. It sounds like that book, your second book, A Kind of Hush, should be a Lifetime movie. It's a kind of movie.
I hope so. Yes.
You know what? I swear.
Yes, I would love that.
I feel like I've seen it before, you know, because you did, you always see this stuff. But anyways, yeah, so my friend Anne Marie's in studio with us, and she's also an author. She's an author of children's books, and she has a question for you.
Hi. What was
What
was your first favorite as an author? Your first favorite.
I'm sorry, what was it?
What was your first favorite?
What was the question?
Your first favorite character as an author.
She wants to know, who was your first favorite author?
Oh, my first favorite author? Mm-hmm. Oh, boy, that's a tough one. There's so many of them. And you write children's books. So I would have to, you know, I lean towards the classics. So I would have to kind of go back to maybe To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee. That made a tremendous impact on me, just from the writing standpoint and just the story that was told in To Kill a Mockingbird. So yeah,
we all read that in school, right?
Yeah, that was one of my favorites,
So Jody, so many people have this dream that they want to write, and they don't really follow it. I mean, I think a lot of people wait until they're retired to write because they're so busy with their career and their families and whatever they're doing in life. And but what kind of advice would you give somebody who says, it's impossible, I just can't do it?
Well, I would say you'd have to kind of go back and remember that you can. It's not going to be easy, but it certainly will be doable if that's a passion for you. And just remember who you were before the world told you who you should be, and just ignore those people that say they might be too busy, they might be, you might be too young, you might be too old to create or to follow a dream. And I think once you get that in your mind and just kind of, you have to put a wall up as far as the criticism, because there's so many odds against you of being successful in terms of ratings and, you know, bestsellers, that type of thing. But the success to me comes from just looking at the book and just saying, I did this, and my book's in the Library of Congress, and nobody can take that away from me, you know. And if it's a success of me just by being able to do that. So
yeah, one notch under your belt, right? It's one notch under your belt.
Yes.
And you know what I do? I've read like a lot of the book reviews about my own book, 18 Brothers and Sisters, that's been selling. It's still selling, and I wrote the book in 2012, and I still get royalties from it, which is a good thing. But I read some of the reviews, and people would write something, and most of my reviews, I have to say 98% are really good, but there's that 1 or 2% mm-hmm. that would say something like, well, maybe something was repetitious, or maybe I didn't follow through with a certain character or something like that. And then I'm like, well, you learn from negativity, right? So how do you handle the criticisms of your book?
Well, you know, I think the first response is a knee-jerk response to have to come back at the person and say, you know, what were you thinking? You know, and have to justify yourself. You really can't do that. It's not a personal attack. That's what you have to get in your mind. A negative review, unless it's something that, like, is, oh, well, the print wasn't big enough, you know, something that has nothing to do with the book. That, to me, those reviews are totally unfair, because they're reviewing the product and not the book itself. So that I have a problem with. But, you know, a one-star review on Life in a Box was perfect, because she just said, it's not my cup of tea, you know, which is perfectly, I mean, that's what you're supposed, that's what a review is supposed to be. So you just, you know, if they're mean and disheartening and so forth, it's hard not to take it personally, but you have to just look at it in the light that it's a criticism, not of you, but of your work, and they didn't like it. So, you know, you deal with it, you move on, and it's a battle that you can't win if you start corresponding back and forth with the negative reviews, if you have those, you know, that it, you just have to just move on from it and learn from it and say, well, maybe it's something I should work on, you know. So you take it more positive than you do negative.
And also, it's easy to just hit the delete button and move on.
That's right.
Just hit delete is a good button.
Yes, it's true. So you had a lot of prodding and encouraging and a lot of cheerleading for your books. What was that message you wanted to convey from your book, Life in a Box? Because Life in a Box is totally different from A Kind of Hush. So you had a story to tell, and I know we only have a few minutes, but what was it? Because like my book, 18 Brothers and Sisters, I wanted to tell about my mother's trials and tribulations with domestic violence, and I wanted to talk about poverty and how we became stronger with poverty and why I believe in birth control after having 17 siblings and how difficult it was for us, right? The hardships and challenges. So what was yours? Because Life in a Box, you said, was sort of kind of like your life.
Yes, it was. And I think that for me, it was just being able to tell a fictional story, but base it on what I grew up with. You know, and it for me, that was, you know, that was the thing that was easy to do in terms of that. But then as I got going with it, everything that happened in Life in a Box was fictional, but the characters were real. And it was fun to be able to put the characters in the book. I had a really good friend of mine who grew up with me in Midland, and her comment was, "I can hear your mother's laugh when I read the words."
Oh,
so to me, that was
that's
the most
a compliment.
Satisfying thing she
that
could
is,
ever,
yes. Yeah, so what is the secret to your writing? Where is that place that you go? Because I know sometimes I will end up writing on my hand, on a tissue, on a box. I mean, sometimes thoughts just jump into my head and I'm planning to write another book in a few years. And I'm like, oh my God. So where is yours? Where's your secret spot to sit down and write?
For me, it's insomnia and discipline, because at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I start scratching out notes on my notepad beside the bed. And then the next morning I read them to try to figure out whether I can figure out what I said or not. But I think you have to write every day, whether it's good or not, and I think you have to read every day. Both of those kind of stimulate the creative process. And for me, just in the middle of the night, I don't know why it comes to me in the middle of the night, but it does. And sometimes I can't read what I scratched out.
I was just going to say, I have sort of the same thing with song lyrics.
Yes.
And I wake up the next morning and I'm like, who wrote that?
Yeah. So for our listening audience who have tuned in today to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, we're speaking with Jodi Neathery. Did I say it correctly this time?
Neathery.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've never heard that name.
That's
beautiful. It is a beautiful Neathery. So we're speaking with author Jodi Neathery. And if somebody wanted to get your books, where can they find them?
It is available on Amazon in ebook, paperback, and hardback. It's available through my website, jodineathery.com. It's available on Smashwords, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble, online, Kobo. And if you want to come to Malakoff, Texas, you can go to a little bookstore we have here, and you can get it there. It's a long way to come from Florida. But anyway.
Well, if ever you make it to Florida, you're always welcome to come and sit in studio with us, and we can interview you again. So, Jodi, how did your family support you writing this book?
Yes and no. My husband is, he had trouble with the amount of time, I think, that is committed to writing a book. You know, as far as he's a numbers guy, so that you put in so many hours and, you know, 10
You'll
hours
never
a
get
day
that out
or whatever,
of a book.
For, you know, and it just doesn't make any sense, you know, to him. But now that I've accomplished 2 books, he's very, very supportive. And my grandsons kept asking me when a Kind of Hush was in the process of being developed, they would ask me periodically what my word count was. So it kind of pushed me into that, I need to get this done, otherwise I'll never hear the end of it type thing. So they put me on the clock, basically. So my daughter, very supportive, and my friends here, my book club, they think I'm a superstar, and I'm going to go with that theory.
Well, we think you are, too. You know what? Anyone who believes in themselves and makes a decision to do something to impact others and make the world a better place. And you wrote your stories. They're out. I mean, who knows where it's going to be picked up. We're proud of you ourselves. And it seems to me as if your writing energized you and made you a more positive than you already are.
I believe that's true. Yeah. Well,
we wish you lots of success.
Yes. Well, listen, Jody, it's wonderful talking to you. I'd love to have you back on another time. You keep enjoying the weather out there. And give us your website or where to get your books one more time.
Okay. The website is www.jodynethery.com, JodeNeathery.com. Also available on Amazon in ebook, paperback, and a hardback. And Smashwords, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble Online, and Kobo.
We're so proud of you, Jody Nethery. I got it properly for the last.
You did.
Got it. Because now it hit me like that Nethery. It's very pretty. What is the origin of that name anyways? Where's that last name from?
We're not sure. We think the Netherlands, but we're not absolutely sure about that.
That's our next conversation, Jody Nethery. We'll have to figure, because I like to figure out the origins of our names. My husband's from the Middle East, and I'm from Trinidad, and it has the Indian, blah, blah, blah. We get it on sometime. But anyways, Ellen, take it away from here.
Again, Jody, thank you so much for calling in. Sita, fantastic new friend of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. But we wanted to give our good friend that's in the studio with us, Anne-Marie Wolf, a few minutes to talk about her book.
Jody, we'll talk to you later. Yeah, so we'll talk to Jody later, Paul.
Yeah.
All right.
But she could hang out on the phone with us if she wanted to. Anne-Marie Wolf is a retired elementary school teacher. Her love of teaching children and reading to them inspired her to write some children's books, and we have them right here in the studio in front of us. Her husband, Jerry, is a retired space network operations engineer, and they both enjoy living here in Florida. And the cool part about the book, Sita, is that the newest, I don't know if this is the newest one or not, but Santa Has Retired was the one that I have here in my hand, and it's all based in here in Brevard County. It has all the cool stuff in Brevard County. So I've been proposing to quite a few of my friends to not buy online and not go find local places and find
local authors,
people,
right?
Support and local authors that are here in town. And Anne-Marie's going to tell us a little bit about her.
Well,
thanks, Anne-Marie. You have to get very close to the mic because Paul's giving me the stinky eye that he's not hearing you properly. Get close up. Close.
We hate Paul's stink eye.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, airtime is expensive. You don't want to lose a minute.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here today. I'm so pleased to be here. And I launched Santa Has Retired in 2019, just before the pandemic. And then I was out reading books to the local schools and getting really good feedback. And due to the pandemic, I had to stop reading to the children. Will Santa remain retired? I did this when I retired thinking...
So you are Santa.
I did this thinking, well, I used to go... I normally go on Christmas Eve to the Surfing Santas on Cocoa Beach, which is a big deal now. And I thought, well, if I could retire, why not let Santa retire? The story is set in the Space Coast of Central Florida. It's a perfect place to have Santa retire. All the area's attractions and places of interest would encourage people to retire and visit here. However, the book is an integrated reading and social science book, which would be beneficial for kindergarten through third grade. It's perfect for buddy reading.
So being a teacher helped you tremendously in writing this book.
Absolutely.
Because you know what the kids were used to ask in school.
Right.
Right.
And it talks about what happens if you get into a rip current, the safety way to come out of a rip current. It also I had Santa go pretty much technology-wise.
He has an iPhone?
He has an iPhone. He tweets.
Yeah, get closer. And so who illustrated your books? Because the drawings are beautiful. The artwork is just
wonderful. Well, actually,
wonderful.
It's Bronwyn Wives. She's my niece. She lives in Redlands, California, and she's a watercolorist. She chose the medium because of the beautiful colors, and she wanted to make it as pretty as possible because of all the ocean
is pretty.
Scenes. Yeah.
Really.
So are you going to do a Santa book for the Caribbean, for Trinidad and Tobago? Because you probably could at this point.
Well, I
Santa
probably
goes
could.
To, Santa goes to Carnival.
Well, there you go.
That would be awesome.
He'd also, be topless, though,
yeah,
right?
I don't know. I hope not.
And also because he's lives in Cocoa Beach, I'm thinking,
maybe could take him on a vacation.
No, I'm taking him into space next. He's going to space. Santa's going to go to space.
Now, my latest, where do we find? Where do we find your books, and where can we find you? Because these books are incredible and so nice that it's a family affair.
Well, let me tell you about my latest book is called Pajamming, and I got the idea to write Pajamming after I observed how much my students love to wear their pajamas in school. So I decided to write it to highlight the letter P. The book is perfect for K through 6. I feel that all young readers would benefit from this. So if you wanted to find my books, I'm going to be at Project Graduation at the Edgewood High School Craft Fair on December 11th. I'll be there from 9 to 2:30. I'll be reading my book and also signing and selling my books. And also, I'm a member of the Space Coast Writers Guild, and they're having a craft fair on December 4th and 5th. At the Cocoa Village Playhouse. You can come see me there. And my email is bistrogal65@gmail.com.
Very nice. And these books are awesome, but we're going to take a quick break, right?
1 minute break, and then we have Dr. Cindy Duke on the phone.
Absolutely. And Anne-Marie's sticking around with us.
That's right.
Portions of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Sita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters, and founder of Simply Sita Skincare, and these great sponsors. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 13 locations, including one in Volusia County. With so many MedFast Urgent Care centers, there is a MedFast near you. MedFast offers top quality care that is close by, and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7. We're also heard on the World Wide Web, Ellen, and we have Dr. Cindy Duke on the phone. She's going to be joining us in a minute, but if you'd be so kind to tell our listeners how to tune in online to our show right this minute.
Absolutely. You can go right to the WWBC website, which is 1510
WWBC. Even you all are excited that Dr. Cindy Duke is calling in.
Like, lost my mind for a second. You hit that on-demand button, and you'll be able to listen to us live, and as well, you download any shows from today or any other Monday that we've been on air for 10 years.
That's
it's
right.
Unbelievable.
You know what's wonderful is that the studio has become like our second living room. It's like our home. It's unscripted, and we tell everybody it's unscripted, so that's okay.
And our brother Paul is here to keep us in
brother
line,
Paul,
so we're good.
Like a true pastor of a church. Oh, my right. God. Don't give him a swell head. Oh, Lord. So for our listeners who are tuning in, we have Anne-Marie Wolf, who is in the studio with us today. She's our guest host today, Ellen and myself. We sit here every Monday, and we talk about things that's going on around the nation, right here in Brevard, and around the world. And so I found a friend of mine, Cora Panton, who lives in Tobago. I'm from Trinidad. Trinidad and Tobago is our twin island nation that I was born in, and I'm very proud of it. I immigrated to the United States when I was 18, like our guest, Dr. Cindy M. Duke. She's an MD. She's America's only dual fertility expert and virologist. She's highly accomplished, went to John Hopkins University, John Hopkins, and Yale-trained physician, scientist, blogger, podcaster, motivational speaker, philanthropist, content creator, influencer, a person, right, like after my own heart. It's right there with me. I can't read it all, Cindy, because I want to give you the time to talk. You're Caribbean born and raised.
Yes,
you're also the founder of a medical lab director of the Nevada Fertility Institute, a full-service reproductive clinic and surgical facility in Las Vegas. So let's chat.
Yes.
Talk to us about yourself.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. And one of the things that I realize we don't include in the bio is I'm also the founder of a virtual women's health clinic that's based out of Trinidad and Tobago. So the Trinidad and Tobago Center for Comprehensive Women's Health, I'm the founder and lead consultant for that. But really, you know, it's such an honor to be here. And hello, Brevard County. Hello, Florida. I am really excited to be here, you know. I think for me, it's always great to talk to a fellow Trini.
Yes.
Because that's when the accent comes out. You know, otherwise we're here and we sort of, I guess, code switch, so to speak. And people are like, I detect an accent. Where is this from? But the moment I'm talking to my mom or a fellow Trinbegonian, suddenly there it is. So I've been here, like you mentioned, since I was 17. We moved to the U.S. when I was 17, going on 18, after completing high school back home. And we've been here now for over 25 years. I currently reside in Las Vegas, but spent 21 years in the Northeast between New York State, Maryland, and Connecticut. And so now we're West Coasters and loving it.
Yes. And, you know, I did look at one of your podcasts, and you have a great ability is where you're connecting with people about the coronavirus. And as you know, there were so many people, minorities, that had all these questions, and they were all, you know, listening to conspiracy theories, and they want to drink Bush tea, and they don't want to take the vaccine, and they think they could eat yam and cassava and get rid of COVID. And I saw that you and your brother as well had done a talk in New York, I think, where with United Way.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed because you being a scientist, I could imagine how maddening this is for you, because my husband is also an ER physician, and he just walks away because, you know, people need to listen to science for this. So talk to us a little bit about what you've been doing to get more West Indians and the diaspora and others to listen.
Yes. Well, you know, for me, that was one of the reasons that brought me out to say, you know, I've been on social media now for the last 4.5 years, actively talking about fertility and women's health, et cetera. But I realized most people didn't know I was a virologist, meaning I have a PhD in microbiology and immunology with a special focus on viral vaccine development and vaccinology. So when I started seeing the myths, and, you know, it's striking that the myths came out really quickly, right? By March of 2020, there were these stories out there saying Black people can't get COVID, Black people are immune. And I'm like, no, this isn't good. Or, you know, people saying that we're going to be fine in terms of West Indian communities, where we happen to know that we have high rates of obesity, high rates of diabetes, high rates of high blood pressure, all the things that actually put you at serious risk for developing severe COVID. And so I thought, you know, one of the important things is going to be people being able to see someone who looks like them, someone who's established a footing in the community, including someone who put a clinic in the community. And so I started having those conversations because, you know what, Sita, it's okay to drink the Bush tea. Bush tea is fine as long as you know Bush tea isn't going to cure COVID. You still need your vaccine. You still need to wear your mask. You still need to take precautions. And so that was something that I did, you know, for the last 5 years. If you look across my social media, I show people the different Bush tea I grew up making.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I remember. And yeah, we all do, right? But it's almost like I, as a nurse, I mean, I hear my friends from Haiti, and they're like, oh, no, we're not taking the vaccine because we're going to drink the Bush tea. And then I'm like, you could do both. You could do both.
You could do both.
Right, right.
And so I spent time doing that to let people understand that it's not either or. It's not someone trying to insult your tradition or your culture. It's the explanation that this is what Bush tea does for you, but this is what it cannot do for you when it comes to how your immune system works. Explain to people that these vaccines are safe, that the so-called rumors claiming that they were tested too quickly is not true. In fact, our vaccine candidates, the mRNA vaccines and the adenovirus, which is Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines, those vaccine candidates have been on in terms of testing for over 10 years. Now, specifically,
specifically designing them with a protein for COVID happened in the last 2 years, but no shortcuts were taken. And in fact, these are the most studied vaccines in the history of vaccines. I also wish to remind West Indians in the diaspora that historically we have had high vaccination rates in our communities. And I share my own personal story, which is Sita, as a little girl growing up in Tobago in the early 80s, I had measles. The reason why I didn't suffer from the worst effects of measles, which, by the way, to this day, measles kills 200,000 children around the world, the measles virus. I didn't get very sick from measles because I had been vaccinated as a little baby there in Tobago.
Yes, I mean, I remember us lining up too in Trinidad, and then they gave us like a biscuit or something for getting the shot.
Exactly.
You remember that?
Exactly.
We got a cup of vanilla milk and a biscuit. Yeah.
I remember lining up.
Hi, Dr. Cindy. This is Anne Marie. I remember lining up for polio vaccines and getting a lollipop.
and you know what? Nobody questioned it back then, right? We just lined up and we just got the shots, and we're still alive. Yeah. And we're here
we're thriving, right? So all these stories of people like, oh, if your kids got the vaccine, they're going to get sick, they're not going to develop well, they're going to be infertile. All of that is untrue. But for many people, if they don't see people who remind them of their own community and culture, they don't believe. The other thing is, many of us grew up knowing this term immunizations. And I think many people somehow think vaccines and immunizations are different. They're one in the same. It's just a different title. And so that's another thing that I spend time doing, is helping people connect the dots to recognize that, you know, you had your immunization card growing up. You know, for those of us who immigrated to the U.S.,
absolutely,
you couldn't immigrate here without providing your immunization card and your immunization records. And vaccine is immunization. That's literally what you've been doing your whole life.
But Dr. Cindy, why do you think there was such a pushback? Because never in my wildest dreams would I have thought that getting people to take a vaccine to keep them safe would have caused such chaos and conspiracy theories and things. I mean, I'm under the mindset that if I get vaccinated, I'm protecting my community. I'm protecting the elderly patients I take care of, my friends, my family, because we're all this together, right? It's an earthly journey, a spiritual journey that we're all beings. And one day we're going to leave the planet. We're not taking anything with us except our good name and what we did, right? But people have made it so political that people like me, who I was always vocal, but then I found myself being one of the ladies that was asked as a minority to get other people to take the vaccine. And I was amazed at friends that I've known for a long time who ate in my house and ate my curry chicken and rice and enjoyed it, that they just dissed me with the vaccine. And I took it personally, because I'm like, dude, you are not doing us any favors by listening to people who say you're going to get a chip in your finger or something, you know?
Yes. And, you know, that's the thing, right? We ended up in a perfect storm, which is what we have had for the last 20 years around the world, is an active undermining of science education, an active underfunding of school systems and educational systems, active undermining of trust in public systems. And then you combine that with a pandemic, with scary news, and then social media, the ability to turn anything viral in no time, pun intended, right? And so one person who has no vetting system can get on a thing, make a video, put a fake background, claim to be an expert, and that thing reaches tens of thousands of people in minutes. And that's what we've seen happen. And in fact, the disinformation campaign is funded. It's being funded by government agencies around the world, because it helps to destabilize economies, destabilize democracies, which is what cracks me up when I hear people talk about vaccine conspiracies, because the real conspiracy is more the people who are actively trying to scare people away from something safe, which is vaccination, and using misinformation, like giving misinformation about Tuskegee. Tuskegee wasn't because a government in the United States gave anyone syphilis. Tuskegee is that the government withheld treatment for syphilis. And so if we withhold vaccines, that's when it'll look like Tuskegee. It's not giving vaccines for COVID isn't Tuskegee. But, you know, I've watched that active twisting of the history of Tuskegee and then scaring communities of color. We've watched the active scaring with the Bill Gates and the computer chip, and this is the same person who's sitting there with a smartphone that has a chip in it that tracks everything that they do.
Yeah. Or, you know, you tell people, well, if you have a cold and you go to the doctor and he give you a Z-Pak, didn't you think scientists made that Z-Pak for you?
Yeah,
so you're going to believe
exactly.
The scientists for the Z-Pak, but for the shot, mm-hmm. you're not going to. And
yeah.
then the other thing is, too, people were calling the mask face diapers. Like, dude, it's not. You know, you went into the hospital, you had surgery, they're going to wear a mask to do surgery. So why all of a sudden?
Yeah.
It's almost like the disinformation went viral and people just chose, mm-hmm. for whatever reason,
they
to listen.
Well, remember the temperature
and
of the
also,
society of yes. what was going on when all of this happened,
mm-hmm.
In general, and misinformation was flying around for everything. So the messaging was never right.
Yeah.
Right.
The messaging was
never right. And it also came on the heels of us having spent the 4 years prior actively losing faith in terms of many people losing faith in the FBI. They lost faith in the CDC. They lost faith in the WHO because we had active misinformation campaigns
correct.
Coming from the
yeah.
very top, undermining confidence in all of these systems. So suddenly expecting the CDC to lead and people to trust them, that's hard.
Yeah.
When you have your own leadership actively undermining Dr. Fauci, that's, you know, so it was just a perfect storm, and it was unfortunate. And we have to be honest, we've had a lot of preventable deaths. I mean, you think of Florida in the last 3 months, there are so many unvaccinated folks who have died unnecessarily. So many families who are currently grieving, just reeling from the loss of family members who are loved, family members who they rely on, whether it be for social support, economic support, that they're gone because
yeah.
they believe these lies and didn't get vaccinated and then succumbed to an otherwise preventable death.
You know, we've seen our infectious disease doctor that works with me. He just throws his hands up in the air. He's like, I don't know what to
mm-hmm.
believe. These people don't believe me when I tell them, and I am the infectious disease doctor, just
yes,
like you are,
yes.
Dr. Cindy, a virologist.
Mm-hmm.
But Ellen has a question because you left Trinidad and Tobago, and look where you ended up.
Yeah, and you ended up in Vegas. How did you decide
on
Las Vegas?
Yeah. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Maybe that's
yeah.
why.
Yeah. So how'd you end up there?
Vegas is just... So I actually, when I was done with my training and realizing I wanted to open a practice, I started looking at locations with a lot of sun. So that included looking at South Florida. I looked at South Florida, Texas. I looked at New Orleans. I looked at California, Vegas. And after doing numerous analyses, I determined that Vegas was going to be the right place for me. It had the right amount of sunlight. No more snow. That was really important to me after 21 years of winter.
Yeah.
In upstate New York and New England. And it's such an amazing community here in Las Vegas. And, you know, we've even found some Begonians here. And Sita, this is going to blow your mind. We literally found a high school classmate of my mom. They sat in the same desk. You know, we do the two-person desk.
Yes.
In high school.
Yeah.
That's the community we've been able to find here. And it turns out there are lots of West Indians in Las Vegas.
I'm pleased to hear that because after this lockdown, I'm coming up to see you and hopefully
yes.
we'll go for some, I'll cook. Your mother is a good cook, but I cook too. But what drives your passion and philanthropy? Is it your mom? Because you give back a lot to the community and Miss Quara
mm-hmm.
is always cooking in Tobago and giving food to people.
Yes. I would have to say it really does come from her. I grew up seeing her do this. I grew up seeing her care for the community. But I also grew up realizing that the more you give, the more you get too. Like, it's not like it's just a selfless giving and rending everything. But that sense of purpose comes from knowing that you've helped lift others, right? So a rising tide lifts all ships. I really believe that. And I know that along our own way, you know, when I started college in New York City, I received a scholarship from the Trinidad and Tobago Alliance. I received scholarships from a number of organizations that were grassroots West Indian and Caribbean organizations within New York City. And so it's never, never departed from me that I am where I am today because of support And so, you know, I started a scholarship program for girls around the world to help provide bridging funds. Because along the way, you know, we came from a working class family in Tobago, moved to New York with only $3,000 total to start a life. And today, here we are, doctor, actor, etc. But it was because of community and people helping. And I remember not being able to afford to go to conferences while I was a trainee, even though the conferences are where you can make the networking opportunities to grow your career. So now we provide bridging funds. So, you know, someone maybe they got a scholarship to a great university, but they don't have money to afford the summer course or to go to the conference or to go somewhere to showcase their work. We will help fund that. Maybe someone is pre-med and they're doing great in school, but they can't afford the MCAT study exam, the cost of the
course. So you're like the big sister.
We will fund that.
Dr. Cindy Duke, yes. You're like the big sister, yes, for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so we have to tell our listening audience, we're speaking with Dr. Cindy Duke, and her name is so easy to say, thank God. And she is a physician founder, medical director, and lab director of a Nevada Fertility Institute, a full-service reproductive clinic, and I can proudly say she's a Trinbagonian like myself. Mm. So,
yes.
So Cindy, you know what? Anne Marie is sitting here, and she is reading your bio, and I think she wants to know a little bit about you and STEM.
Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead.
Have you always been interested in STEM?
Yes, ma'am. So, you know, my mom, Sita's probably heard the story. I was that three-year-old who would go around the house injecting people with needles, not syringes, but like a sewing needle, giving them injections, going outside and, you know, pounding leaves together. If anybody in my family said they were sick, I would run to go make them medicine or brew bush tea for them.
Girl, you need to start marketing that bush tea because I think it's going to be wonderful. But so you know, I told my children about your mom, and then I told them about you, and then I said, well, I think her brother is famous. And they're like, Mom, what do you mean? So I told them, and they're like, Mom, you don't know who Winston Duke is? And they're like, did you watch a Black Panther? I'm like, yeah, I did. And they're like, do you know this guy, Mbuku or something? I'm like, yeah. And they're like,
yes.
Well, he's pretty famous, Mom. And it's one of the highly gross film in the U.S. And then so I said, oh, really? So really, that's wonderful. He's famous. But his sister, and they're like, she's more interested in the sister. So tell us a little bit about your family.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just the two of us, my brother and myself, and we're 8 years apart, so my mom spaced out her kids a lot. But what that also means is I was an only child for
yes.
a little over 8 years, and so it was just me and my mom, and I think that was an amazing way to grow up as a young woman in the islands, watching my mom navigate her journey into entrepreneurship and womanhood and being a single parent and just doing things that she thought were necessary, but teaching me how to stand up for myself. And she definitely stood up for me, which is one of the big things I like to encourage all parents, especially West Indian parents, is don't ever be afraid to advocate for your children, because we are where we are today because my mom advocated, made sacrifices, and always believed that we were capable of doing amazing things. And she always shared that with us. You can do whatever you want to, as opposed to saying this is what you should do. Like, she never told me you should be a doctor. My interest in STEM was my interest, and what she did was make sure that people didn't dim that light. So if teachers tried to suggest I couldn't do science, my mom was like, why not? You know, if they thought that a girl couldn't go to medical school, which happened even within our own family, and my mom was like, but why not? And so I really am grateful for her. And the same for my brother. When he announced that he wanted to be an actor, the one compromise my mom said was, promise me you're going to get your degrees first. And so that's
spoken
what he did.
Like a true West Indian. We all say
a
that.
True West Indian.
I know.
Yes.
When my daughter came home from UF, University of Florida, and she said to her dad, mm-hmm. I don't want to be a doctor. My husband said, you have two choices, law or medicine. And so she picked law. And when my yes. son came home and said he wanted to go to Hollywood, I said, listen, you still have to have a degree. And I sat bawling and crying. If God take me now, I want to know that you have a college degree. I don't want to tell the Lord I came to America and my kid is a this and that, you know. You know, because we sacrifice
you
so
need the
much.
Backup plan.
And we
yeah,
sacrifice.
Exactly.
So, well, one thing about your mom, too, that I find, and I just feel this from her, and correct me, is she's very spiritual. And when
yes,
she's driving
she
with you in LA, and I'm like, I'm like, who is that driving this car for this? She's talking about the hills, and she could feel the spirit, and she's going to see your brother and whatnot. And then I'm like, you know, that she is what everybody wants their mother to be, a woman that encourages her children, removes stumbling blocks, believe in her children. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wonder, where was she when I came to America with $5 in my pocket, catching my royal nen-nen over here? You know, I needed her. So you are very blessed.
You know, she's been a mom to so many people and continues to, you know, like, as you mentioned, during this pandemic, she spearheaded these massive campaigns back home. So the first was we paid money for groceries and then said to families, you can go to the supermarket and buy this much worth of groceries. So we didn't dictate what you can get. You can go, as long as it's not alcohol or cigarettes, you can go and get as much food stuff worth of this value without having to worry about money and a tank of gas.
Yeah. Oh, my God. She's amazing. But listen, we have 3 minutes left of the segment. I'm going to have you back again. I just love talking to you. But
absolutely.
Tell me really quick. You're known as America's only dual fertility doctor and virologist. How do you navigate that role, being both? And I know Paul is giving me the 2-minute signal. So if you could tell us in 2 minutes.
Well, I'll say it really quickly because I think, you know, people are like, well, did you know that there would be a time where you would be necessary? Because, like, we talk about all those myths about fertility and pregnancy related to the vaccine and so forth. And so for me, it's been actually pretty easy to put the two together. I come from a really unique perspective because I can talk about the science, I can talk about the basics of the immune system and what vaccines mean, but also completely tied in to what our hormones are doing, what our reproduction is doing, and what our future would look like with expertise. I'm not just saying it because I'm guessing. I am saying this from a fully, fully informed background, and that's been really helpful.
In other words, you know what you're saying, like they say back home.
I know what they're saying. Exactly.
You could talk. You could put your money where your mouth is. But give us your website because you're amazing, and you motivate so many women, and especially women of color, minorities, people who needed to hear that they could be the best they can be by just believing in themselves. And you do that for me and so many people. And your voice is needed, not just here in Brevard or the United States, but around the world. So give us your website.
Yes. So you can find me at drcindyduke.com, all one word, D-R-C-I-N-D-Y, duke.com. And then I'm on social media at Dr. Cindy M. Duke. All social media, that's the same handle, a Dr. Cindy M. Duke. And it's been an honor to be here today. And by the way, Sita, I'm receiving an award this weekend from the Caribbean Heritage Awards for their forerunner.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
I hate to cut you short, but we have got to go. We're out of town.
Hi, Cindy. I just looked at your picture, and you're absolutely beautiful.
I'll keep up with you. Thank you.
We're going to make sure that all this great information.
Enjoy the day, guys.
Okay.
We'll make sure that all this great information is posted on our website as well as our Facebook page, Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Please tune in next Monday here on 1510 WWBC.
The preceding program may not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of WWBC.